You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko kēsta tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Caster, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Alex. If I can, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about making English an official language of Aotearoa and reducing the minimum proposed homes for Auckland down to 1.6 million. I also spoke to Dr. Mohsen Mohammadzadeh from the University of Auckland School of Architecture and Planning about PC 120 and how to best develop Auckland as a city for the future. Alex, what have you got for us today?
I spoke with Senior Lecturer in Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, Timothy Welch, about the Infrastructure Commission's suggestion of a $9 toll on the Harbour Bridge, whether it's the right move, and what it means for Auckland's infrastructure planning.
He aha o whakaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pā, tuhi mai, text in on 5395, or wai mai rānei, give us a call in studio on 309-3879. Kawa e wareware e ahana koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō. Hei pakihere rokiroki mārunga i te pai, tukutuku o Erirangi Poho, me haere ki 95BFM Irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more as always by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
The government has been in discussions this past week over a bill adding English to the list of New Zealand's official languages. Currently, the list comprises only Te Reo Māori and New Zealand Sign Language. The bill is being criticised as pointless and a waste of time by opposition MPs, while its main supporter, NZ First Leader Winston Peters, suggests it is common sense. Also this past week has seen Housing Minister Chris Bishop announcing changes to Housing Plans PC 120. While the plans had previously proposed a minimum housing capacity of 2 million for Tamaki Makaurau, the quota has been lowered to 1.6 million. The change follows criticisms of the plan from some who say intensification could harm the character of their suburbs, especially in wealthier areas around central Auckland. For our weekly catch-up with ACT Simon Court, I asked about each of these issues, beginning with English as an official language. Talking about the proposal to make English an official language of Aotearoa, why is this proposal coming about and why now?
Well, most New Zealanders do speak English every day and they expect to see it used clearly and visibly in public services. This proposal for a bill to reinforce that English is an official language of New Zealand has been made into a culture war by some people who oppose it, but it's really just making sure that people can easily understand information they rely on, and the government is doing its part by clearly communicating with the public that it serves.
Yeah, I'd argue that the culture war part has been coming from both sides. We've seen both opposition parties accusing the government of wasting time by putting it through, but also Winston Peters, New Zealand First Leader, putting forward this bill claiming that it's a return to common sense, we're finally prioritising English. What do you make of that, I guess, the division being sown on both sides?
Well, I can't speak for Winston Peters, the comments he's made specifically, but it is a government bill, and the reason it's a government bill is because the government wants to make it very clear, and ACT supports this, that if there is going to be public communication by government or taxpayer-funded entities, that that is in English as a priority, that is government policy, there are cabinet directives to that effect, so that means that when road signs go up telling you about the Manawa to Tararua Highway, which taxpayers have paid nearly $1 billion for. People who are looking for that road see Manawa to Tararua Highway up there, not some other name that might have been gifted to it, which, while it's important, cannot possibly be the thing people are looking for or searching for on Google Maps. And it's the same when people are going to the library. The word library indicates where the books are, notwithstanding that some councils have taken upon themselves to completely replace that word with a te reo word, which means the place where books are kept. So this is government policy and making sure that English language is an official language simply reinforce what is existing policy.
There's a few other things I want to get to there, but I just want to clarify something. You used the phrase Manawatu Tararua Highway as an example of English language signing, and that sort of speaks to me and to many people about the questionable reasoning for this change. A lot of our place names already are in Te Reo Māori. A lot of the words we use in everyday language to refer to lots of different things related to government especially are in Te Reo Māori. What is the reason behind, you know, insisting that we need to add English here? It seems like almost a symbolic gesture rather than anything else.
Absolutely not. English is the language that we require immigrants to New Zealand to be proficient in order to obtain a work visa. It's the language of law. If you go to court, you're seeking a judgment. The judges write that judgment in English. And, you know, by referencing Manawatu Tararua Highway, they're place names. The New Zealand Geographic Board has chosen them. Using other vernacular or Te Reo Māori names or any other words to describe things that are most helpfully described in the most common language for the most number of people. I mean, remember, you know, English is the language spoken by the vast majority of New Zealanders. And so simply reinforcing that that's the language that we should use, like the term highway to indicate the road you're going on, doesn't seem much of a stretch or something that people would, you know, be able to object to, except if they really have some kind of philosophical objection to it.
You've mentioned all of these examples. You know, highways is a big one there, government directives, legislation in our courts. You say this bill is important. You say it's not symbolic. Does that mean that these things are not in English right now, that we can't view these things in English? Because, I mean, as far as I can tell, and as far as many other members of the public can tell, these things are predominantly or entirely in English at the moment.
Well, I think it's very important that the legislation reflects government policy, and you know this government has had a policy of putting the English term for public services or public documents, public buildings first, so that it's obvious what this thing is to the vast majority of people who speak English as a first language and many their only language. And so that's government policy. The legislation simply gives effect to it. Now, to say there's not a problem, I think obfuscates very real issues that New Zealanders have raised, rightly raised, when going into hospitals and seeing Māori terms, for example, Te Reo Māori terms being used to describe, being used essentially for wayfinding in the hospital. They find it confusing, particularly when they're often an already vulnerable or confused state of mind on the highway. If you're looking for the brand new, nearly billion-dollar highway, the Manawatu Tararua Highway, seeing a sign that describes Te Ahu Aturanga, while it's appropriate, you know, to have that that name somewhere, having it on the road sign, and that makes it very, very confusing for people who are to find the new billion-dollar road. So, look, I mean, this is just practical. It's constructive. It shouldn't be a culture war issue. It's hard to understand why objectors are so vitriolic about it when, you know, English is the most commonly spoken language in New Zealand.
All right. I want to move on now to the changes to PC 120. We've seen Housing Minister Chris Bishop announce the reduction of the minimum housing capacity for Auckland from 2 million to 1.6 million. Why has this change come about?
Well, the government has made good progress by adjusting the housing targets to better align growth with infrastructure. But we're not quite there yet, because while zoned capacity matters, infrastructure has to keep pace. And developers have been telling us that their biggest barriers to getting more homes built in Auckland are slower consents, exorbitant development charges, in some cases up to $130,000 per dwelling, having to be forked over to council even when the infrastructure is not there yet, and really costly connections to services like water and wastewater. So before Parliament signs off this change to better align the number of potential dwellings in Auckland to the infrastructure that's available, ACT is asking for one more thing, which is that Aucklanders get to see the maps that Auckland Council has where these 1.6 million dwellings are proposed to go.
There's claims that, or I guess there's been complaints from people seeing these PC 120 plans in wealthier suburbs such as, you know, Epsom, Ponsonby, some East Auckland suburbs as well, complaints that the housing intensification would affect the character of the neighbourhoods. Is this something that we should be considering when developing these housing policies?
Well, I think that's pretty typical of the characterisation that many people have made about the complaints. But I'll give you an example. I live in Te Aratu Peninsula. This area has been subject to intensive development over the past 5 or 6 years. And we've seen many, many single-family homes removed and replaced with multiple units. What that means is certainly the community is more vibrant, there's more people here, there's more demand for shops and services. But what's also happening is that there are vehicles parked all over the berms. Emergency services and trucks can't get through residential streets to make deliveries. We've got wastewater blowing out sometimes every 2 to 3 days. And you know what you've seen in Wellington Harbour is happening in the Henderson Creek 60 or 70 times a year. We've got all kinds of nasty things hanging in the mangroves. When you go down to launch your kayak or launch your Wakarama, go down to the sailing club, it's horrendous. And so people are legitimately concerned the infrastructure is not there to keep up with development. And it doesn't matter where you live in Auckland, unless we solve that problem, it doesn't really matter what number goes on a plan.
Yeah, Simon, I think the problem here is not... that speaks to the problem here, you know. The fact that we're getting intensive developments in places like Te Aratu, in places like Avondale, which don't have the transport infrastructure to support a higher number of people. Somewhere like Epsom, you know, it's very close to the CBD, and many people travelling in every day, you know, could walk, could take the bus. And so, obviously, when you get huge developments out in Te Aratu, I mean, I'm based out west myself, and you can see that these big developments depend on people having cars. Why can't we instead have these big intensification projects in places close to the CBD?
Well, I think we can, and that's the purpose of the changes that the government is asking Auckland Council to consider and that are being proposed in legislation. Because you think about Epsom, the 7 train stations in Epsom. It makes sense to build up around the train stations. But you get a certain distance away from them because, remember, Epsom's quite a large electorate. It doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense to be building 6, 8 or 12-storey apartment buildings in residential streets, which are currently single-storey homes. But we can have it all. We don't have to, this is not a binary choice. I think what's been offered or proposed to Aucklanders is actually, instead of being allowed to grow up and out, Plan Change 120 essentially ring fences the existing metropolitan urban limit, ignores the fact that there's tens of thousands of hectares of developable land where people want to live, in fact are building and living, tens of thousands of them out in the northwest in places like Kumia and Huapai and Waimauku, where the infrastructure is not being provided to them by Auckland Council. So we've got all of these different issues that we need to resolve. Yes, intensification around transport nodes makes a lot of sense, but we also need space for people who want to park a boat on the front lawn and put a trampoline on the back lawn. We can have all of these things. We've just got to get the balance right, and simply zoning to put 2 million people, 2 million new homes into the existing metropolitan urban area was never going to work.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court speaking to me about English as an official language of Aotearoa and the PC 120 changes for Auckland.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire. We'll be right back. This is Doubt by Slowpulp.
Or you 95.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Mind Your Own Business by Delta 5.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
PC 120, or Plan Change 120, was announced for Auckland as a way to boost housing intensification along public transport networks and in the CBD. The plan was celebrated as a way to ensure Auckland remains livable as a city into the 21st century, reducing traffic around key centres and increasing affordability. The plan was met with criticism from those living in affected central neighbourhoods, such as Mount Eden, Parnell, Ponsonby and Epsom. Some residents say the changes will diminish the character of their neighbourhoods or make things busier, disturbing their way of life. Intensification is difficult, therefore, as a balancing act between multiple parties. To discuss how developments can work as we move into a city fit for the 21st century, I spoke to Dr. Mohsin Mohammadzadeh from the University of Auckland School of Architecture and Planning. On PC 120, I guess for anyone who's unfamiliar with what the plan looks like at the start, why is it being put in place, and what does the plan at a very basic level aim to do?
It's a very good question. The thing is that we are growing, you know, as a city, and obviously the demography is changing, and also, you know, the growing means actually we need to provide more houses. You know, and it's kind of the challenge all the time for us, you know, as planners, you know, to think about it, how we can manage it, you know. So there are a couple of the the solutions, you know, and sometimes we have a greenfield development, so we release lands and, you know, just built in, you know, kind of the new and built a new neighborhood or town close to the city. And but it's quite costly, especially in the long term. It's not quite sustainable sometimes. We are using most of the time fertile land, you know, to convert it to a kind of the residential, and in the long term we cannot bring it back.
Right. Yeah.
And we have a very limited resources about this one. And also, it's a kind of thing. It increases the cost in the long term, especially for the transportation and infrastructure. Mm. Because most of the time when we going for a greenfield development, we are aiming for a kind of the low density type of developments over there. And we develop the infrastructure based on that low dense ones. So it's long term. When we expand the city, very low dense, transportation, providing transportation, especially public transport, it becomes so expensive, for example, for a council, for Auckland Transport now is a part of the council. So it associates with some costs, and also it will be costly for people. If we don't go for a public transport, we'll have more traffic. As planners, we have another option, which is kind of the brownfield or kind of the infill development type of things, you know, intensification within the metropolitan area, you know, and it's one of the solutions. We are going for townhouses, apartments, and a different range.
Right.
But again, you know, obviously we are facing another type of issues. One of the limitations is the existing infrastructure, the capacity of existing infrastructure, like water or the network, the, you know, transportation network there. Sometimes it's a kind of limitation. And also characteristics of the neighborhoods,
yeah.
You know, and especially for people, you know, living in that area, you know, they somehow they have a concern,
yeah.
You know, because if we don't plan it well, I totally understand what people think. You know, if we don't plan it and put it in the right place, potentially can kind of adversely impact on the quality of life of people over there. So. Yeah, it's a kind of the things all the time we are dealing with this kind of the criteria. So, yes, the plan aims actually to provide the kind of the houses that we really need, you know, and we know that housing all the time, at least, you know, for decades, it was a kind of a major concern, especially for a younger generation. So, yeah, the plan aims actually to provide more options, especially for the younger ones, for the new demography we have, and the different type of needs, instead of the standalone houses in the, you know, in the new developed areas.
Because we see with these standalone houses and with this model that Auckland's been, instead of expanding upward, we've been sort of broadening outwards south and especially up north, you know, into those neighbourhoods there. There's been some criticism of this, that it causes some kind of problems. You hinted towards transport. Is there anything else that, any other problems that this creates from a planning perspective?
As I mentioned, you know, the first thing is that we are using our fertile land actually to convert it to the residential.
Yeah.
So we have very limited, people assume that, you know, land is available, you know, because they can see it.
Yeah.
The reality is that fertile land is quite a rare resource, you know, so it's quite, we need to protect it. It's the first thing. So most of the time, we are using that kind of fertile lands actually for residential.
Yeah.
The other thing is that if you look to the long, as I mentioned, in long term, you know, because we develop them for the based on the low density again, in the long term, we'll not have enough capacity actually to intensify that kind of neighborhood. So it means that the process of growing means that we are all the time going for the greenfield development.
Mm.
Obviously, for some groups, it's created kind of the benefits. We understand it. It's a kind of the money issue. But in the long term, I don't think it would be quite beneficial, you know, for a city. Because especially the cost of the operation, infrastructure, providing that kind of service, quality service for people. And also somehow, I think it would be quite expensive for the younger generation. Because most of those kind of buildings, they are quite big. They are 4 or 5 bedrooms, and they are not designed for the young ones. And especially for the young ones, they are working in the CBD or other, you know, kind of the, name it, kind of job hubs, you know. Mm. They are quite far from them. So it means that the young ones, they should pay for the house, but also they should pay for transportation.
Yeah.
You know, so it makes it quite unaffordable for the younger ones. when we put things together, it's a kind of the things we have it in Europe and also in Australia these days. You know, we are going for more intensification within their urban areas, especially to provide more opportunities. You know, townhouses, different types. You know, it's quite to respond to the different needs of the people, not just big houses with 4 or 5 bedrooms.
Yeah,
we've had traditionally.
Yeah, that seems to be a big thing in terms of developing these plans, you know, loosening restrictions around some of these central city suburbs, Ponsonby, Mount Eden, Parnell, Epsom, these places, because young people are some of the biggest users of these central city, or certainly the biggest commuters into these central city places for university, for work, as you mentioned. If we're thinking about increasing or intensifying in these neighbourhoods, what kind of benefits could it pose for younger communities looking to break into the housing market, looking to find a place to live?
Very good question. The thing is that actually most of the developments we have, intensification within this kind of the inner suburbs, we name them, there are like a townhouses, apartments, which is more affordable for renting and also for ownership. And also the other thing is that because they are quite inner, we have more frequent public transport, better access to the facilities, easier and cheaper, especially for the young ones if they are commuting to the city or other centers like Newmarket or other places. We have a lot of job opportunities. So it would be more affordable for young ones, you know, and also even regarding commuting, it would be less traffic, you know, in the city, because when people actually travel less, means that actually they stuck less in the traffic. So, and obviously reduce the cost. But I totally understand, you know, the concerns of the people who are already living in this kind of the areas, because they have characteristics, you know, and there are very kind of the high demand for people to leave that because of the quality of the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
If we don't consider the needs of the people and characteristics of the neighborhoods, and we just intensify it, and we don't consider the limitations of existing infrastructure over there, and also the characteristics, this kind of neighborhoods potential losing their characters and also the quality of life.
Right. Yeah.
I think that most of the time people misunderstood, people when they discuss about misunderstood about the concerns of people there.
Yeah.
In that case, I think, you know, it's a very complex. We need to consider the needs of the youth, obviously, and what's benefit for the city. But at the same time, we need to consider a couple of the other things. And colleagues, for example, we have the School of Architecture and Planning and Design. We have heritage teamed over there, and they are considering how the characteristics can be maintained, you know, and somehow. And also we have urban design group, you know, they look to the how we can shape this kind of the new development aligns with what we already have.
Yeah.
So intensification, perfect, but we need to do it, you know, wisely and carefully.
Balance.
Yes, absolutely. To respond to the needs of the all people, you know.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask is we have seen quite a few apartment buildings pop up in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, but they don't tend to be concentrated around the CBD. They tend to be, you know, cropping up in these outer city suburbs and even further out. And people have criticized this for creating traffic issues, creating pressure on schools, creating other problems there. Is this something we can continue doing alongside intensification, or what is the scale of this as a thing we're doing?
Very good point. Yes, we can see the intensification apartments, you know, in the not necessarily around the metropolitan centers and town centers. There's a reason, because of the land value.
Right.
If you want to build a kind of the couple of the houses as a attached townhouses, or if you want to go for apartment, you should have a kind of the big block, you know, kind of the piece of land. And when that kind of lands are quite close to kind of the metropolitan centers or town centers, the land value is quite, you know, expensive. So sometimes developers actually select a piece of land that are not necessarily close to that kind of amenities. So it dictates by the land value. We have a couple of the colleagues working, you know, in the school, and also, as I know, in the business school, are working in that kind of area. So, you know, and how the land value somehow directs that kind of the developments. But at the same time, you know, we know that, you know, when we open up a kind of particular area, you know, for example, for intensification, land value automatically increase significantly. Because when you permit for the intensification, the land value increases automatically without any kind of, just right. by the plan yeah. itself, you know? So somehow it's perceived as a kind of the obstacles, you know, for mm-hmm. developers especially. Yeah, it's a kind of very complex, you know, very complex issue, you know? So we need to consider a range of things. And also, I agree, in the, some aspects we need to check this, you know, and sometimes I think people forget when we are going for intensification, we need to check the existing, the capacity of existing infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Does, for example, the roads and network we have over there can accept that level of the, you know, pressure increasing the number? Because when you build houses,
yeah,
you know, it you know, people start living there, it creates a kind of the commuting, you know, people mm-hmm. traveling, yeah, on roads,
yeah.
Do you have a capacity for it?
Mm.
Or, you, for example, the other one, sewer system is working or not for that mm. number of people, you yeah. know, or the water pipes, you know, the system can offer that level of the water. We have a lot of examples around the world when planners, you know, they just think about the beneficial and economic dimension and ignore that kind of the foundation of the intensification. And then at that kind of, when the project materializes and built, the quality of the space dropped significantly.
Yeah.
So it's again, it's a very complex, multi-layer things: engineering, economics, politics, social, cultural ones.
You mentioned the cities that we see in Europe with this intensification style are very close around urban centres, and now that we're seeing in Australia as well, do you think we'll ever see something like that for Auckland? I think it's possible.
To be honest, it's the only way we mm. can, I think, the most feasible
yeah.
and appropriate way to accommodate people. We have a young generation. We have a kind of the new type of needs in the city, and we need to place them, mm. you know, and we need to consider their needs. But yes, it's a kind of, as a planner all the time, we consider that, you know, what's the socio-cultural, economic dynamics over there, how we can provide the best service, you know, for people, and also create a good urban, you know, kind of spaces to respond to the needs of all people.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's inevitable, but how we plan it and how we implement it, it's a big question.
That was Dr. Mohsin Mohammadzadeh from the University of Auckland School of Architecture and Planning, talking about how to make Auckland a city for the 21st century and balancing multiple parties around intensification. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM.
Yeah, how you worried about a gold digger with no gold? she doing a truck. Zip flying in, fly out. Your passport still in your mom's house. Matter of fact, you still in your mom's house. You the man of the house and your mom's out. I dance on a beat like MJ, but I stand in the back like Tito. Her titties flat like plasma screen. I still wanna watch TV though. We do it first, they see the moves. I swear they bite so fucking much. They say you are what you repeatedly do. I guess I'm a fucking cunt. Sometimes I laugh when I show criteria when they rise up. Feel like dad at bedtime. Walk in the room like that's enough. You do too much. Talk about taking a break so much. We need your lunch. You do too much. Bro, just shadow boxing. Beat him to the punch. You do too much. Please don't do it again. Please don't interrupt. Doing too much. Renzo, tell him again. Don't think they hearing us or no.
BFM and Slick.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Doing a Lot featuring Church and AP by Renzo and The Dreaming by Kate Bush.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
Last week, the Infrastructure Commission's first National Infrastructure Plan was released. Outlining a number of different suggestions for infrastructure, the plan has been tabled to Parliament by Infrastructure Minister Chris Bishop. One such suggestion is the introduction of a $9 toll on the Harbour Bridge and any new harbour crossing in order to fund the construction of that new crossing. I spoke with Senior Lecturer in Architecture and Planning at the University of Auckland, Timothy Welch, about the suggestion and how it should play into Auckland's infrastructure future. Just to get us started, can you explain what the Infrastructure Commission has actually suggested with these tolls? Is it as simple as just a toll on the bridge?
Yeah, what the Infrastructure Commission really said is if we look at the price of the toll on the original bridge, which was tolled for a number of years to help offset that cost, and we inflate it to current dollar value, then we'd be looking at a toll about $9. I don't think that they really are genuinely suggesting that that should be a toll on the bridge, or the current bridge, or even a future crossing, or that people should really be paying that, or that would be a real way to finance the bridge. It was more of just, this is what we once paid for this infrastructure. But beyond that, I'm not sure that they're kind of genuinely saying this is what should be done.
Kind of looking at the way that a toll has funded this bridge and could fund this bridge, what sort of intent does this kind of show from the Infrastructure Commission towards kind of funding our current crossing and new crossing?
Yeah, and as a country, we have a huge list of infrastructure projects ranging from small to mega projects, and a new bridge would kind of fall, or tunnel, would fall into that category. The problem is that for the next decade or so, we've essentially already allocated most of our infrastructure funding towards existing projects. The bridge isn't, or crossing isn't fully funded in that scope, nor are kind of the roads of national significance that the current political party in power wants to see happen. So we have a number of projects that aren't funded. And so what's suggested is there's going to be a need for additional funds to pay for any infrastructure that's not already kind of allocated funding, which this crossing would fall under. So in theory, a toll could then offset some of that cost or help fund the cost of another crossing. That's the idea, and whether that actually works in practice well is often another question.
Looking at this, the second crossing, is the second crossing the kind of thing that we maybe should be putting funding into in the scope of our wider infrastructure projects over the last 10 years? Is this something that we should be focusing on as a city?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we could ask is take a step back even farther and ask, do we need an additional crossing? And the reality is the traffic across the bridge peaked in 2017 or 2018, depending on how you look at the numbers. So we're pushing almost a decade of very little growth in traffic across the bridge. The real constraints tend to be a lack of public transport and other alternatives across the bridge and some of the roads that lead up to the bridge rather than the bridge itself, and also the timing when people are trying to cross. So if we were to manage our demand for the bridge a little better, we may not even need another crossing, and then we wouldn't need kind of that overall discussion of how are we going to pay for another one or should we be programming another one. But yeah, ideally, we've been talking about a second crossing for 40, 50 years now and haven't come up with a solid plan or solid funding. And so it's something we really should have been thinking about and finding funding for decades ago, not kind of as a last-minute option after we've already decided we need that additional crossing urgently.
Nicola Willis has kind of explicitly said that the government is not necessarily following these recommendations, especially around the toll. Is this the kind of thing that if the government wants to focus on the second Harper crossing, regardless of whether or not it's the best move, is the toll the kind of way that we should be doing that? Is there other avenues that we really should be looking at for fundraising outside of kind of the pool that we already have?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of issues that come up when we talk about a user pay model, which tolls kind of fall under. But I think it makes sense to look at the numbers first. So if we look at kind of the original bridge that was tolled, it cost about £7.5 million at the time, which is about $250 million today. But if we look at it in terms of overall economic impact, it was about cost us about 7.5% of our nation's GDP at the time. So in today's dollars, that would be basically $19 billion. And the bridge estimates today are around $25 billion or tunnel or whatever second crossing we have fall around that $25 billion mark. So if we're looking at a $9 toll, I know these are a lot of numbers, we would need about 2.8, almost 3 billion trips across that bridge to pay for another crossing, the current bridge. So, you know, right now we have 63 million trips. We're talking 44 years of tolls just to pay for a second crossing at the current cost estimates. So, I mean, it's really not something that's going to pay for a substantial amount of a new crossing. So we really should be looking at ways to either kind of more efficiently use the infrastructure we currently have, which can be things like more public transportation, options for walking and cycling that will reduce car traffic demand. Those are kind of the big wins and the cheapest wins we could do right off the bat, and we could do them very quickly. And then we could consider what we really feasibly need in terms of additional infrastructure that wouldn't require decades and decades of tolls to find funding.
As a user pays model kind of for funding, obviously there's going to be a lot of concern maybe from a lot of Aucklanders around what they'll end up paying to go across the bridge. If we're looking at a toll of, say, $9, is this likely to really be felt by Aucklanders, or is it likely to kind of come back in a certain way?
Yeah, I mean, there's a certain kind of rationale in saying if you're going to use the bridge, you should pay for it. But there is a substantial group of people who $9 to cross the bridge is quite a hit. You know, we're talking if it was told both ways, we're approaching $20 each day just for driving across, and then the same people need to find parking on one side or the other of their trip, et cetera, et cetera. It becomes really expensive, especially for people in lower income brackets. So there's a question of who gets hit the hardest by tolls like this, and what is really the point if it's not paying for the infrastructure, and if it's not trying to manage the demand for that infrastructure, then is it really just kind of taking money out of people's pockets, especially the people who can least afford that sort of thing, especially when we're not supplying additional capacity for more affordable public transport or active mode trips? If we're making everybody drive across the bridge that needs to be in a certain place at a certain time, no matter what your income is, it becomes a potential problem.
Looking at kind of the impacts that these tolls would have on the average Aucklander and kind of the effectiveness of building that second Harper crossing, what then, you've already spoken about, like, you know, using what we have more effectively in public transport, but what specifically should we be looking at in that field to kind of get the most out of fixing our traffic through infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, there are current studies, not run by the government, but done independently, that have shown that if we use a single existing lane for public transport or active modes or a combination, we can essentially offset most of the current congestion on the bridge. It seems counterintuitive because we're reducing the capacity overall in terms of vehicles, private vehicles, but when we add better bus trips, faster bus trips, and more of them, and more options like walking and cycling by using a lane, we actually make it much more efficient and give people many more affordable options that they aren't forced to be in a vehicle to cross that bridge. So the simplest thing we could do and the lowest cost and the fastest we could do it and within very quick time frame would be to utilize one of the existing lanes for alternative modes that aren't people in their own cars driving across the bridge. That could be done in months, not decades.
With that in mind, kind of looking forward into Auckland's infrastructure futures, with these, you know, lane changes to accommodate for public transport, what else should the government be looking at to kind of build up an effective transport system around our bridge?
Yeah, I mean, that's the bulk of it. So we already know that we have a great busway on the North Shore side of the bridge. It's really efficient. It's one of the most effective public transport investments in the country in decades. So it's very well used. The problem is that we don't have that same kind of dedicated busway on the other side, on the city side of the bridge. So we can get buses effectively from the North Shore, you know, all the way up the North Shore over to the bridge very rapidly and efficiently. But once we hit the bridge and cross into the city, buses have to be in traffic most of the time. And so that kind of additional capacity that's added on one side of the bridge doesn't exist on the other and creates bottlenecks. So we really need an efficient, networked route of busways and even, like I said, cycling and walking lanes that can allow people to cross over that aren't in a car. You know, when you're in a vehicle, you're taking up tons and tons of space versus when you're on a bus or in a bike, on a bike or on foot. So those efficiencies are huge gains that could created not just across the bridge, but the entire network. And we could spend a lot less money building more roads and just using them more effectively.
When we're looking at the cost figures that are being bandied about, especially, you know, considering a second harbour bridge, what sort of difference between the cost would we be seeing between going into these grand infrastructure projects and just simply making sure what we have works?
So if we look at kind of the numbers, and these are all just back of the envelope numbers because we don't have full costs yet, we spend about $100 million in studying a second harbor crossing in the most recent kind of studies. That's $100 million we spent just kind of seeing if we can do a bridge or a tunnel, if it's feasible. For $150 million, we could have created that additional walking and cycling and potentially bus lanes on that on the bridge itself and the included infrastructure kind of leading up to it to make that efficient. So for a very little more than we've already spent just studying the idea of a second crossing, we could have already had the efficient capacity or the efficient infrastructure on the bridge to make all of this work. We also have, you know, we've had proposals of a completely separate walking and cycling bridge that's floated for less than $1 billion years ago, but considered way too expensive. If we had that and invested at the time, you know, that seems like a lot of money. We could have also had a much more efficient use of our existing bridge and already had that done and paid for. And before that, we had another option called SkyPath, which is kind of adding on to the currently added on bridge on the clip-ons, which would have added walking and cycling options for a cost far lower than all of these things. But all of these kind of have been mixed, and we're now looking at essentially the most expensive, least feasible option of all, which is potentially a tunnel under the harbour.
That was the University of Auckland's Timothy Welch on the suggestion of a harbour bridge toll and how we should be looking to fix the harbour bridge.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rahina Monday. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Auckland's Dr. Mohsen Mohammadzada, and the University of Auckland's Dr. Timothy Welch. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongoana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Penny.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.